Then I saw the most striking and unforgettable aspect of Jesus' face. His eyes. The eyes of Jesus flashed with blue and gold and green, drawing me into a deep sense of eternity. Then I saw the most striking and unforgettable aspect of Jesus' face. His eyes. The eyes of Jesus flashed with blue and gold and green, drawing me into a deep sense of eternity. The eyes of Jesus were filled with relentless love for me, for you. These eyes that had never seen my devotion or worship, that had never met my eyes looking for him. His eyes spoke volumes to me, and as I gazed more deeply I saw something that moved me then and moves me to tears even now years later. In those eyes was a well of both compassion and sorrow. There was sorrow for those who had not acknowledged or recognized him. There was sadness for how I had personally lived my life apart from him, so much time and life lost and squandered. Yet, there was a great love for me that so encompassed me that I felt as though I was the only person ever born. In those moments suspended in eternity, I was his sole focus. This same love is available for all people who know and turn toward him. And with this gracious love flows forgiveness for all. Now the tall angel stood in front of Jesus, and as he bowed low he brought something out from the sleeve of his robe. It appeared to be a very thin book of some kind, which the angel then opened for Jesus to read. It was as thin as a menu from a local diner. I don't know how, but somehow I knew that this was the book of my life, filled with both good and bad. It was a thin volume with sparse entries of any kindness or love I had shown for my fellow man. My heart sank and my soul was crushed with the most incredible shame. I had invested my life in myself, mostly ignorant of the needs of other people around me. As Jesus began to read, the angel turned his face toward me, focusing those beautiful violet eyes on me. Then I heard his voice in my thoughts saying to me, "James, what did you do with the life my master gave you?" Sadly, I had no answer. I stood face to face with Jesus, exposed. I was filled with a deep despair and wondering how such indifference could dwell in the presence of such love. Yet, Jesus never referred to the thinness of that book. He never looked down on me with shame or judged me. The shame and regret were mine, not his. I had judged and condemned myself. In the midst of this face-to-face encounter, another feeling flowed from Jesus: joy. His face was set on the edge of a smile, and I knew that his heart was to impart his joy to me. His joy had nothing to do with the volume of good things I had done, whether thick or thin. As Jesus was silently reading the book, my life unfolded before me. The words he read became images that leapt off the pages of the book and into my mind, pictures of events from early childhood to the most recent days before my experience in heaven. As they say, my life flashed before my eyes. It did not take Jesus long to read the thin book of my life. He had been inclined forward and now he straightened up, with the angel now bowing more deeply. Though Jesus' stature did not increase, he seemed to be even taller to me. The book was now closed and the angel replaced the book in the sleeve of his robe, and vanished. I was filled with anticipation as it seemed that Jesus was about to speak to me. It is that feeling in the air before a thunderstorm that comes during a hot summer's day just before a clap of thunder. Then, I heard the most elegant, deep baritone voice speaking my name, "James." He spoke audibly to me now, not as thoughts transferred. To hear that voice speaking my name penetrated to the deepest part of me. Jesus, the Son of God, spoke my name. His voice caused me to stagger for a moment, and I wanted to kneel as the angels had when Jesus first appeared, but the angels kept me upright. When Jesus spoke my name, he held out his hand to me with the palm turned upward and toward me in a gesture of invitation. I tried to move forward and could not. I was frozen in awe. But when Jesus held out his hand, I saw the radiant light of his garment shining through a hole in his wrist, the wrist that had been nailed to the cross for me, for all of us. It was not a bloody or jagged hole, but clearly an odd-shaped scar he willingly took upon himself. The moment I realized it was the scar of the crucifixion, I was filled with an overwhelming sense of profound sadness, guilt, and shame. I felt sadness for the savage way my sin had killed him. I felt guilt for ignoring his sacrifice all my life. I felt shame for the life I had led. It was so personal and intense a moment. It was as though I had held the hammer and driven the nails into his body. But when Jesus held out his hand, I saw the radiant light of his garment shining through a hole in his wrist, the wrist that had been nailed to the cross for me. Now Jesus looked directly at me with eyes filled with compassion and love. Something life-changing happened in that brief encounter. How I longed to see those eyes again. All that I had searched for my entire life was fulfilled in those eyes and the words he spoke to me. He knows my name. Now Jesus fixed his total attention on me and spoke, "James, my son, this is not yet your time. Go back, and tell your brothers and sisters, of the wonders we have shown you." While these words were brief, they were long on meaning for me. Though Jesus did not speak many words to me, they were powerful and transformational. James. To hear the God who created everything speak my name had deep meaning for me. He knew my name. I was not some anonymous blob of humanity. I had a name and he was speaking it. As Jesus spoke my name, I sensed my value in his eyes. Jesus knows who I am. When Jesus spoke my name, it was as though I was the only person ever born. His next words poured life into my empty heart and fulfilled a longing I am just now understanding. "James, my son, this is not yet your time. Go back and tell your brothers and sisters of the wonders we have shown you." My son. I had longed to know a father, a dad. From my school days when I would occasionally climb the hill to the cemetery where my earthly father was buried, I wanted a dad. Many times, I longed to hear my father answer the frequent questions that all kids have. Though I had a great father figure in my grandfather, all kids notice the absence of a dad. Dads teach a kid how to throw a ball or steady them as they learn to ride a bicycle. Being called son also made me a part of the family of God and gave me a new identity and purpose beyond myself. "This is not yet your time." This meant to me that there would be a time when I would find heaven again as my home for eternity, to live in the nowness of God forever. Forever present. Forever known. How I yearn and long for that time when I will see Jesus face to face again, living in the city of the King for eternity. But his next words moved me from joy to sorrow. "Go back and tell your brothers and sisters of the wonders we have shown you." His words were not a suggestion. They were a mission and I was his agent. I must come back to my question, who am I? Who am I to tell anybody anything about God and heaven? I am not a preacher or Bible scholar. In fact, I've not spoken before crowds of Christian people or churches. In the world's estimation, I was not a bad person, but I might take ethics to the edge in a business deal. Life was all about me. Now, having received this commission from the mouth of Jesus, my arrogance was revealed. Before my experience with heaven and Jesus Christ, I was only concerned about what I possessed. Now my life was possessed by Him. My qualification for this new mission would have to come from the sheer grace of God. I was out of control. How could it be that I was being sent away? I had finally come home. The experiences and the heart of heaven had begun a process of transformation and compassion in me. Though I can tell this great story, the greatest evidence of its truthfulness is my own transformation. I carry heaven in my heart with me into all of life. As I look into the eyes of other folks, I cannot help but recall the eyes of Jesus as we stood face to face. The assignment. Now, staggering somewhere between fear and joy, I tried to move toward him but the angels held me back. I had interpreted Jesus reaching out toward me as an invitation. But the hand that was extended toward me to reveal the scars of his passion now rotated upward with his palm toward me. My heart stopped. My heart was grieved. How could it be that I was being sent away? I had finally come home, my yearning was being fulfilled in that moment. I began to tearfully plead with Jesus, "Lord, please let me stay. I won't be any trouble. Jesus, let me stay with you." The angels were now holding me back, and I remember trying to struggle past them to get to Jesus. It was pretty useless to resist angels that were more than twice or three times my size. To my astonishment, when I turned once again to plead with Jesus, he was no longer there. In his place stood the tallest angel who had suddenly reappeared. He looked at me with tender loving kindness and with some sorrow said, "I am sorry, James, but you have to go." As he spoke, he extended his wings, clothed in immense power and authority, but barring my way forward. The next thing I knew, I was in the same tunnel that transported me to heaven, traveling in that same silent, windless light speed. And then I was aware of a different face and a far less gentle voice raised toward me, "James. James." Chapter 9. The Return Journey. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago, whether in the body I do not know, or out of the body I do not know, God knows, such a man was caught up to the third heaven. And I know how such a man, whether in the body or apart from the body I do not know, God knows, was caught up into paradise and heard inexpressible words, which a man is not permitted to speak. Back in the tunnel, with the angel's voice still resonating in my heart, I was drawn back into the same tunnel that carried me to the fields of heaven, and it felt as though I was traveling even faster than before. I could see the light at the end of the tunnel, though this was a dimmer, earthly light. This would not be as soft a landing as my journey to heaven. I was sliding down through the tunnel and beginning to feel something I had almost forgotten while in heaven, pain. In those moments, there was no thought of the mission to tell my brothers and sisters anything, only the reintroduction to my earthly life. The world and my physical body felt like a cold, wet, slimy place to live. I began to feel an overwhelming sense of the loss of heaven. Now the euphoria of heaven, angels, and the face of Jesus was being replaced with the descent into my physical body and pain. I felt something strange on my face, a slapping that grew in intensity with each blow. I was told later that the doctor was trying to revive me by slapping my face. It was as if I was being delivered the way you would stimulate a newborn child. Maybe that's what a newborn baby experiences, going from the security of the womb into this cold world. It was as if I was being truly born again. The world and my physical body felt like a cold, wet, slimy place to live. I began to feel an overwhelming sense of the loss of heaven. Gradually, I could feel the oxygen mask, meant to bring air, actually seeming to obstruct it. My body was covered by a white sheet. With each breath and beat of my heart, the precincts of heaven grew more faint. I was suffocating in my earthly body. At the same time, the boundless freedom of heaven was being supplanted by a strange feeling of captivity. The full reality of what had happened was beginning to dawn on me. I was connected to a respirator, and when I began to breathe on my own, the alarm began to go off. To everyone's shock, I was alive. How could this be? I was gone and now was back again. Apparently, they wrote, 11 hours with no sign of brain activity. Nonetheless, here I was, alive. It is impossible to describe the contrast between where I found myself and where I had been only moments earlier. The music of heaven's flowers was replaced by frantic sounds of medical activity. The warmth of heaven's home was now supplanted by a cold and hostile place. The soothing voices of the angels were now sounds of medical terms concerning me, and the calm of heaven's garden was now a personal maze of confusion. What was happening to me? My first lucid thought was, "Where is Lorraine?" The hospital called my wife from the quiet room and explained to her what had happened, to everyone's medical amazement. You will hear this from Lorraine's perspective in the following chapter. Lorraine came rushing in. I tried to speak to her, but my voice and air were obstructed, as I had been intubated because I was not able to breathe on my own. I grabbed Lorraine's hand and said, "Lorraine, I was in heaven, I saw Jesus, Jesus had horses. I was back but in terrible shape. My physical body was seriously ill. At least one of my lungs had collapsed, and I had a raging case of pneumonia. I spent a long time in the ICU. I had tubes down my throat and I couldn't speak to tell anyone of my experience. As I regained consciousness, the tubes were removed. I grabbed Lorraine's hand and said, "Lorraine, I was in heaven, I saw Jesus, Jesus had horses." Lorraine said, "I don't know what you saw, but you have been going on about seeing Jesus." She said, "I know you better than anyone. I couldn't make out what you were saying. The tubes really ruptured my vocal cords. But as soon as I could speak to any degree, I kept telling this story to her. I seemed desperate to report what I had seen. Putting the story together. An amazing part of my experience were the doctors who were surprised at my return and recovery. I am forever grateful for the professional and compassionate care I received while in the hospital. From the doctors to the other medical staff, the care was first rate. At first, my prospects for recovery or even life itself were dim. For all intents and purposes, I was gone. I had no brain activity for several hours. At first, when I awakened, the story of my experience was as disconnected as I was connected to medical devices. I have the analytical mind of a pilot and businessman, and I am always trying to figure things out, to get my position right. Some aspects, the angels, the flowers, and mostly the eyes of Jesus, were intact, if out of sequence. The amount of time was a mystery to me. Others with similar experiences have reported events that took hours when in fact they were gone for only minutes. I don't think time is very important in heaven and the realm of the spirit. We live our life by the clock as creatures of linear time. In heaven, past, present, and future collapse into an eternal now. No one is looking at their watch there. Eventually, I began to put the timelines and sequence of the experience together. Pastor Luke Weaver, Jr., leads a church 50 minutes from us. Our daughters have done rodeo together. Before my experience, I knew him casually but paid little attention to his spiritual activities or position. He was one of those Christians and a pastor. I did not want anything to do with that. Pastor Luke had come to the hospital earlier to pray with Lorraine and ask if there was anything he could do. The more time passed from my experience, the more I began to try and make sense of it. I had been questioning myself as to the reality of all I saw. Was it drug-induced? Was it a hallucination? When Pastor Luke visited me, I began to tell him of the doctor's report to me, that the medical staff had done nothing that would have induced that hallucination. In fact, there was no brain activity. Luke then told me the most important thing I had heard since my experience in heaven, "Jim, I believe you." This gave me the courage to continue to share my experience. Once I was well enough, I sat down at Pastor Luke's huge kitchen table and said, "Luke, I'm really worried that there is something wrong with me." "What's bothering you?" Luke inquired. I responded, "Luke, I wake up somewhere around 3 a.m. out of my sleep recalling and almost reliving my experience in heaven. I begin to write furiously. Then I get up in the morning and read what I've written. I've filled more than 5 journals. There is so much and it is so vivid. Luke, did I dream all of this? Is this my imagination? It has been such a psychological journey for me. Did I dream all of this? Is this my imagination?" I read some of my journaling to Luke with his wife Bonnie sitting nearby. As happens many times, the wisdom began to flow from her. She said, "Jim, look. The experience that you had was so overwhelming, so all-encompassing of your senses, that if God had intended you to know all of that at once, you couldn't have stood it. You couldn't have taken it. You would have blown your mind." And she was right. It was like many folks who have a shocking experience that takes time to unfold and understand. No, I have not become the sage who came from heaven. There are many things I saw and heard in heaven that I do not yet understand. I try to share my experience the best I can. Some that I do not understand I will likely never share. There are eternal truths that I still try to understand with an earthbound mind. While in heaven, it was as though information was being downloaded into my soul. However, I do not have all the answers to all the questions people have asked me about heaven. I still wrestle with the question, who am I? That God should allow me to experience all of these wonders of heaven. As our times together unfolded, Pastor Luke would sit at the table with me while I shared the emerging details of what I could remember. As I said previously, I had begun to recall and record the details of all I experienced in heaven in several volumes of a personal journal. I had little or no biblical knowledge, but as details of the experience arose, Pastor Luke referred me to scripture. For example, When I mentioned about there being no sun or celestial source of light in heaven, Pastor Luke referred me to the book of Revelation. And the city has no need of the sun or of the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God has illumined it, and its lamp is the Lamb. Each part of my experience began to be clarified with Luke's guidance. He became a mentor to me, as did his wonderful and godly extended family of Grace Chapel in Pennsylvania. I will be forever grateful for Luke's patient heart as he listened to me and the Holy Spirit at the same time, beginning to make sense of what I learned in heaven. Most of what I learned was about the heart of Jesus and my relationship with Him. I had the most extravagant experience, then had to come back and learn about what I had experienced. The example came before the lesson. I realized that my process in putting all of my story together was the reverse of how most folks learn. Most of the time, we would read and study a matter, then have some experience or object lesson to reinforce what we have learned. But in this case, I had the most extravagant experience, then had to come back and learn about what I had experienced. The example came before the lesson. It was like being sent to a foreign land where I did not know the language but learned more as I was immersed in that country and culture. The thing that remains with me is the longing for the presence of Jesus. Yet even in this life on earth, for which I am grateful, I have come to an assurance that there is more, that there is a longing on both sides of the veil to be reunited with Christ for eternity, to see those amazing eyes again and hear the resonant voice of Jesus speaking my name once more. I am grateful for the life I have now and that I have been given a mission to tell you about all that I experienced. The yearning for heaven persists and the knowledge that I was created to love and be loved by God. There is no medical or practical explanation for what happened to me or even why it happened. But the fulfillment of my yearning is now as close as my memory of my experience of heaven and Jesus. It is as close as speaking the name, Jesus. Jesus. Chapter 10. The View from This Side of Heaven. Lorraine's Story. My sleep was restless. I was very tired from working extra hours at the long-term care nursing home where I serve. Jim said he might go to the movies and had not yet come home. I had woken up several times through the night. Something was wrong. At one point, I thought I heard someone rattling around the kitchen and assumed it was Jim. Somewhere in the early morning, my workplace called and awakened me for good, but Jim was still not home. I got up and looked around the house and outside. Jim would usually be up tending to our horses in the early morning. But he was not there. His truck was not there. Where was he? I began to call Jim's cell phone repeatedly. But there was no answer. I walked quickly from place to place, my heart began to fill with anxiety, my pulse was increasing, and my breath growing slower with each step. Rolling around in the back of my mind was the prayer that I offered a short time earlier. Though Jim was not a deeply spiritual person then, he had at least gone to church occasionally. In recent years, however, he had grown more preoccupied with his business and his pain and had wandered even further away from anything to do with God or church. Years before, I had begun to pray, "Lord, if you must break Jim to remake him, do it." Now, my petition of recent years to break Jim filled me with guilt. Had something happened to him? Was this the doing of my prayer? Was this my fault? Where was Jim? I had a bad feeling that something was terribly wrong. Entering into full alarm, I called my sister, Shelley, but spoke to her husband, David. He relayed to me that Shelley too had been awakened several times during the night to pray, though she did not know for whom or what. But there was a sense of urgent intercession in her prayer. Out of the blue, another sister, Jean, was also awakened to urgent prayer. She felt God was telling her to call David and Shelley immediately. Jean thought her prayer burden might have been for our father, who was ill and in the same hospital Jim would eventually be taken to. I added a call for advice to a family friend, a firefighter, Jerry, who told me to call the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, RCMP. The RCMP came to the house and talked to me and got the number to Jim's cell phone so that they could use it to find his location. Soon there was a small group at our home, three of my sisters, one of their sons, and a brother-in-law. Our friend the firefighter stood close by but was not with us in the prayer circle. There were six of us whose hands found each other in the middle of our kitchen as we joined in a circle to pray for Jim. None of us had any idea what had happened nor what Jim was experiencing at that moment in heaven. While they were looking for Jim, Jean's son Matthew, Shelley, her husband David leading the prayer, another sister Karen, and I held hands and were praying that Jim would be found soon, alive, and kept safe. David led the prayer that if it was the will of Jesus, he would send Jim back to us. We had no idea what the RCMP would soon find. As we were holding on to one another in prayer, a knock came to the door. It was a constable from the RCMP. He entered the house with a concerned look on his face. Removing his hat, he said, "We have located your husband, Mrs. Woodford, and it doesn't look good. We were able to break into the truck where we found him. Paramedics are working on him and there is a faint heartbeat, but it doesn't look good. They are taking him to the trauma unit at the hospital." One thing that had complicated Jim's medical condition was that it was very cold and he had been in his truck without a coat. There were six of us whose hands found each other in the middle of our kitchen as we joined in a circle to pray for Jim. None of us had any idea what had happened nor what Jim was experiencing at that moment in heaven. With that, the constable took me to the trauma unit at the hospital. My sister Karen was with me. It was all surreal to me, as though I were living some kind of night terror. I was numb and in shock. When we arrived, the physician came into the quiet room adjacent to the trauma unit to talk to me. The constable stayed by me while I talked to the physician. Neither the doctor nor I had any idea what had happened to Jim. The doctor asked me if Jim was on any kind of medication and I described what Jim had been taking. He stood by listening, trying to get an idea of what had happened. But there was nothing to be done for Jim now. After hours of no brain activity, Jim's eyes suddenly opened. His various systems began to function once again. We were all astonished. They transferred him out of the trauma unit to a coup. An attendant escorted me to a quiet room off the ICU. There a doctor spoke to me in a kind voice saying, "Mrs. Woodford, your husband has no brain sign. He is clinically deceased and has been intubated. We are keeping his breathing and heart going, but not for long. There is nothing we can do for Jim. You will have to let him go. If you have anyone who wants to see Jim before he is disconnected, then please ask them to come immediately." By this time, Jim's kidneys and the rest of his body had begun to shut down. As an RN, I knew what these signs meant. There was no hope. I updated my sisters regarding Jim's condition and the doctor's report. All the while my sisters at home, Shelley and Jean, continued to pray that Jim would be fully restored. They are relentless and faithful prayer warriors. Now they took me into the room to see Jim. Though I had been an RN for years, I was taken aback by the sight of Jim hooked up to several machines. This was a strange sight for me. Jim was always full of life, independent, confident. He was known as Diamond Jim. It seemed he could do or fix anything or handle any problem. Even in the face of serious problems, Jim would say, "That's not a big deal, we can fix that." Now he lay motionless and still. His life signature had been reduced to the single beeping of the heart monitor. How many more beeps would there be until we heard that last, long signal and he would be gone? The words of my prayer kept coming back to disturb me, "Lord, if you must, break him to remake him." I too prayed for Jim to be restored even though, as a nurse, I understood the words of the doctor. I prayed that God would restore Jim and that he would not be impaired in any way. All I could do now was to pray, all the while feeling the guilt from my prayer, "Break him to remake him." All at once, one of the ICU nurses came to me and said, "Mrs. Woodford, please come here quickly." Now there were medical people rushing around everywhere. After hours of no brain activity, Jim's eyes suddenly opened. His various systems began to function once again. We were all astonished. I began to wonder how much of Jim could possibly still be there. He had been brain dead and much of his body shut down for many hours. Now, with his eyes opened, Jim was trying to talk to me, but he had been intubated and couldn't speak. After a while, as his breathing slowly improved, they removed the respirator but kept it on standby. Jim was struggling to talk with a scratchy, gravelly voice, so I bent my head down to listen closely, and to my astonishment I heard Jim say, "I saw Jesus, and Jesus has horses."